colleague in the Department of Philosophy who called me, it must have been over the summer, and said he'd really like to see Mershon host an event around the development of a barrier in the West Bank being built by Israel. And we talked about how we might do that. And basically, I said to Joe, as long as you do it, it's okay with me. And I want to be honest, Joe did basically everything in putting this together. And all my role is to start. I'm going to introduce in a little while Amos Giora more formally and John Quigley more formally. They are both distinguished experts on international law, and they will talk about the legal aspects of the barrier in a few minutes. But I am going to spend about 10 minutes, maybe even 15, but I hope not, making sure that we all have some sense of what it is we're talking about, in the sense of what is this barrier, where is it being built, and what is it constituted of. It's a physical barrier. It's comprised of a network of fences, walls, and trenches. Most of it's fence, about 90% of it. Julie, why is this going forward? It's not advancing. So we need it to advance. There it is. It's really slow, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, a barrier was first thought about in 1994. Whoops, I went too far. why
Here,
don't
I'll
go back?
I'll go back to your second spot.
Yeah. The initial idea in 1994 actually was during the Rabin government. No, I want to go back at the beginning. And they did build a barrier in the Rabin period. They built it around Gaza, which would be the first map I wanted to show. And the barrier in Gaza hasn't been that controversial in international terms. Why is this so slow?
I don't know.
Just slide two. Okay. It has a number of crossings, and you can see them on the map here. And some of these crossings are in the news quite a bit because they have been the target of a number of attacks and the places where lots of stuff has been found. And there's a corridor outside Rafah here, this Philadelphia route, that has also been in the news a good bit lately because of the tunneling that's going on. And for the most part, as I understand it today, we're not going to talk about the barriers around Gaza. We're going to talk about the barrier in the West Bank. And the barrier in the West Bank is much more difficult. This is an official Israeli Foreign Ministry map of where the approved and authorized portions of the barrier will be built. It's it started getting built actually after about 2000, maybe 2001, after the negotiations had more or less petered out. So while there was talk of it as early as 94, and there was actually notions it would be made, it didn't actually start getting built in any big way until the last 3 or 4 years. Now, I'm going to come back to this map. It may be out of date already, but it's very difficult to see. You can see it coming somewhat along the green line here, which is the original, or the armistice line. And I'm going to come back because I want to look at particularly places like this, which we'll call a balloon, where Arab areas will be completely surrounded. But what does it look like? A lot of it looks like this, where you'll have a fence, a trench, another fence, security road, and then another fence. And more up close, this is what the Israeli Defense Ministry puts out to show you what its sort of prototypical form will take, which is, this is the West Bank. And you can see a fence, then a deep trench, and then another fence, the patrol road, and then after the patrol road, a series of observation electronic monitors. And it's running along those circuitous routes that I showed you encircling part of the West Bank. And it's currently authorized to build about 400 miles at this point, at the end of 2003. Now, there are other barriers in the world on this scale. In India and Kashmir, the building began along the line of control. The 1972 line began largely in the 1990s and was completed in 2004. And that barrier is about 330 miles, so roughly comparable size. Morocco has built a barrier separating the Moroccans from the Western Sahara to keep, in their view, the Polisario out, and it runs around 1,500 miles at this point. It's about 9 feet, 10 feet high, combination of sand dunes, fences, trenches, and landmine areas. And the Green Line in Cyprus is also fortified and divided. Northern and southern Cyprus, it runs just under 200 miles long. So in some ways, this isn't unique. The two lawyers can tell us how it is or how it is not similar to barriers in other disputed territories. Parts of it look like this. Parts of it are walled, pretty imposing walls. But this constitutes less than 10%. The vast majority of it are either kind of lesser walls, like this, or the big fence, which is the majority of it, I was showing you a minute ago. And some of it divides cities or little villages, cut right through it, like the Berlin Wall used to. And some parts of it, they're crossings in most places. They look about like this. And in cases like this one, which I want to come to in a minute, in the West Bank, I want to focus in on one of these balloons, one of the ones that's captured a lot of attention lately, this Kwakalia, just because I have nice aerial shots of it in a minute. But you can see what's happened in that particular Arab village here. This is the Green Line. It's completely surrounded by the wall because there was the desire to protect certain Israeli settlements out over here. And it's not unique. But what the consequence of the walling will be, this was a satellite photo of that village. This is why we say picked it. In March of 2002. And I want you to look around the perimeter, which is open at that point. And this is June of 2003. So this hasn't quite been completed along the Green Line, and there'll be some entry and exit posts there. But one of the consequences of the barrier in places like this is that the population in this village who farm the territory outside the wall are separated from their farms. And so there's this human transportation issue. That's the point of these gates. Sometimes that picture of the gates I showed you were school children, because sometimes the school's on one side of the fence and the homes on the other. And that's especially true in places where there's encircled territories. Now, where will the wall end up? That's a question that obviously only time will tell. The map I showed you that's very hard to read on the PowerPoint, you actually have to study it pretty carefully, even up close, shows the authorized portions at the end of 2003. Now, I'll come to a moment, just within the last 2 weeks, the Israeli cabinet on the 21st of February changed some of the route. And I'll talk about that in a second. And so it's an issue of constant adjustment. They're actually pulling some of it back to take up less of the West Bank. They're deviating less from the Green Line than they were going to previously. And I'm sure there'll be more adjustments, maybe the other way, depending on how the bargaining goes over the next several months. This is a map put out by the BBC. And what I want to draw your attention to is this is maybe a cleaner and easier to see rendition of that very messy thing I was showing you in terms of the boundary along the western part, where there's a green line and then a barrier that comes out to surround certain territories to protect West Bank settlements. This eastern line is not authorized to be built as I understand it. So this is kind of a fear of the BBC, reflecting Arab fears, that you could imagine them continuing around. And if you want to look at my other map, the messy one, there are authorizations to go around the top near Jenin and down in here a little bit, but not this, at least not now. And why would anyone think they would ever build the Eastern Wall, which would essentially encapsulate all the Palestinians? Well, this is the Oslo map from the Oslo agreements. And if you recall, Oslo set up a series of stages where territory would be surrendered in terms of its control to Palestinians. And in the first phase, these brown areas would be turned over to Palestinian control, and they were. And in the second stage, the yellow areas would be turned over to Palestinian control, and they were. Now, they've been subsequently re-controlled, but the movement to allow that independence of the Palestinians went fairly far by the year 2000. And it might have been easy to get because these are where most of the Israeli Israeli settlements are, where it's green. This is a map of Israeli settlements on the West Bank. Now, if you put those two maps together, you can see why Oslo was possible. It was possible to surrender control to the yellow, not surrender to the green. And when we got to the problem of working about the future settlements, the whole process by then had collapsed. And it's beginning to start again. But if you compare where this green settlement is compared to where Palestinian Authority was autonomous to the maps I was showing you a second ago, you get a picture of why Palestinians come to worry, and the BBC comes to worry, the EU worries, that there'll be an Eastern Wall. Because if you're going to protect the Israelis over here, you might decide to protect the Israelis over here as well. So this happens to be a map coming from a left-wing group in Israel that's Jewish and worried that this could be a future of this separation wall. This is what the PLO has on its website, PA these days, on its website. It's a little more draconian in what it fears of the future. And again, these are future, but where the barrier ends up is, of course, something that people are discussing right now, and only time will tell. Maybe our two experts will have some sense on that. Now, in October of 2003, the United Nations Security Council received a resolution declaring, and let me quote, "The wall and the occupied territories departing from the armistice line of 1949 is illegal." Now, that resolution was vetoed by the United States in the Security Council. In June 30th, of 2004, the Israeli High Court of Justice, the Israeli Supreme Court, ruled on a series of complaints brought by Palestinians. And it found two or three things. Let me sort of tick off, at least as I understand it, what the Israeli Supreme Court found in June. First, it held that the territory in question is held in a state of belligerent occupation, and that therefore both Israeli administrative law applies, as does the Hague Conventions and the Fourth Geneva Convention. And I'll leave it up to these two to tell us what the Hague Convention and the Fourth Geneva Convention specify for its parties. But the Israeli Supreme Court argued those do apply in these territories. Second, that the construction of the barrier for security reasons is okay, will be allowed. It's legal in their findings. If it was being built for political, economic, or social purposes, it would be illegal. And thirdly, they found that the planned route as announced at that time, remember this was in June of 04, last summer, failed the test of what they called proportionality. And they argued under the international regulations, proportionality meant the harm caused to the occupied people had to be in proportion to the security given from the barrier. And they announced that 30 kilometers of the barrier should be rerouted. And as I understand it, the Israeli government agreed and is conforming or complying with that Israeli court finding. But again, I'm not the expert in this. We'll let the lawyers. Now, in July, on the 9th of July, 2004, again last summer, the International Court of Justice also ruled on the barrier. And it ruled against the barrier. The case was brought by parties in the General Assembly of the United Nations. And the ICJ found that the barrier should be removed and Arab residents be compensated for any damage done. And the court advised the United Nations General Assembly and the United Nations Security Council to act on the issue. And we can go through the formal five findings of the court. Four of them were found 14-1, and one of them was found 13-2. We can talk about the dissenting judge in a minute. Now, Israel had previously announced in January that it did not recognize the ICJ's jurisdiction on the barrier issue, arguing primarily that the barrier is a political issue, not a legal issue. And as a political issue, it doesn't have status in front of the ICJ. So, needless to say, they didn't abide by the ICJ's finding. President Bush, as well as Colin Powell, the day after the ICJ finding, also rejected the ICJ's jurisdiction. And Colin Powell gave a very public address saying that in his view, the case should have never gone to the International Court of Justice, and it was entirely up to Israel whether it would react to the findings of the court or not. And at the time, there was a campaign going on, and Senator John Kerry outdid the president, saying that he found this an outrageous abuse of the International Court of Justice. It should have not been there, and that the wall, as he called it, was an essential tool in Israel's fight against terrorism. So there wasn't much support for the ICJ in the U.S. In terms of this. Now, as I mentioned, the barrier, or separation in general, is a very popular idea in Israel. It enjoys, in every poll I've been able to find in preparation for this afternoon, well more than three-quarters of the support of the Jewish population of Israel, usually closer to 85% who approve it. It doesn't make it legal, but it certainly makes it unlikely that the Israeli government will change course and tear it down anytime soon. Now, what will happen as negotiations resume between the Palestinians and the Israelis with this is something I can't predict, nor could anyone else with any confidence. As I mentioned, just in the last few weeks, the Israeli cabinet, as part of the decision to withdraw from Gaza, announced just a few weeks ago, also in that same cabinet meeting, decided to change the route of the barrier to protect a few settlements around Jerusalem and in the southern West Bank, and to bring it closer to the Green Line in some other places. Now, if the wall, barrier, fence, whatever we're going to call it, would be completed as it's currently authorized, about 8% of the West Bank territory envisioned just a decade ago in the Oslo Accords that would have been part of a Palestinian state, maybe 7%, somewhere in that area, would now be behind the barrier on the Israeli side, and the other 92% would still be on the Palestinian side, assuming there's no Eastern Wall. Joe, wanted to have lawyers come talk about the importance of the ICJ, the Israeli Supreme Court, the U.S. position, whether international law can help in or hinder in this issue at all. And I think he's found two very excellent people to help us work through the details of this issue. They're going to speak first, John Quigley, who's a distinguished university professor here at Ohio State. He's the recipient of the Distinguished Scholar Award here at Ohio State. He's been on the faculty for more than 30 years. Okay. He's been a scholar everywhere from Harvard to Moscow. He holds adjunct appointments in political science. He's been a representative or an attorney for lots of different international tribunals, including those in Palestinian cases before, as well as the investigations of crimes against humanity in Cambodia. He's written very extensively on the laws of humanitarian protection, human rights, United Nations, and war and peace. He'll speak first for about 20 minutes or so. Lieutenant Colonel Amos Giora is currently visiting a professor of law at Case Western Reserve, where he teaches courses on national security law, counterterrorism, and is involved in the development of a national security program in law there. He served for 19 years in the Israeli Defense Force Judge Advocate General Corps. He held a number of senior command positions, including commander of the IDF School of Military Law. He's been Judge Advocate of the Navy and the Home Front Command, and legal advisor to the Gaza Strip issues. And he will speak secondly. So I think without any further ado, thank you, John. Unless you want any of my maps up there, I'm going to turn the podium over to you.
Thank you. I'll do without. I tried to pull up a map of the revised route, which I got off the IDF website. But unfortunately, I couldn't make anything out of it, and I couldn't enlarge it. So I can't really tell you too much about what it said. The opinion that the International Court of Justice rendered in July was is called an advisory opinion. And I think there's been confusion in the press about exactly what that means, and Rick talked about Israel's objection to the courts having jurisdiction, and Israel did object, but this was not a case between two parties. That is, Israel was not a party or a potential party to the case. What happens is that the Security Council of the UN and the General Assembly of the UN, when they're dealing with some matter, have the option under the UN Charter, if there's some legal side to what they're doing, of asking for an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice. This is a kind of a procedure for a role of a court that we don't really have in the United States very much, to have a court issuing an advisory opinion. There are actually a couple of states, Massachusetts, in fact, has it. But most states in the United States and the federal government don't have that. That is, we have to have an actual case between two parties before a court has jurisdiction. The idea is that the General Assembly will need guidance on something, and that it can ask for the opinion of the court. And when the court gives an opinion, it's therefore not binding on the General Assembly. It's not binding on any states that may have an interest in the matter. But it is a statement by the court of how the court views the relevant law. So it's a statement by the court as to what the court views as being binding under the law, apart from its decision. So it's not binding as a decision of a court on anyone, but it is an effort by the court to say what principles it views as being binding for the resolution of a dispute. And that's how this case got to the court after the Security Council considered this matter of the barrier, of the wall, and the fence. I don't know what to call it either. Then the General Assembly took up the matter because it has a procedure whereby if the Security Council is prevented by the veto of a permanent member from dealing with an issue, then the General Assembly may take up the issue. This is a procedure the General Assembly instituted during the Korean War when the Soviet Union was vetoing resolutions in the Security Council about Korea, and the United States, in fact, initiated the procedure in the General Assembly to allow the General Assembly to get involved. Anyway, the General Assembly took the matter up and at a certain point said we would like a legal opinion from the court. This was quite controversial in the General Assembly. Most of the European countries abstained on that vote. They thought that it would have been better to let the political process work itself out. So all the European countries abstained. But there were enough votes in favor of the resolution that it passed. It was negative votes for Israel, the United States, and a few others. And then the court took the matter up on that basis. Interestingly, after the court issued the opinion, the General Assembly again took up the matter on a resolution as to whether there should be implementation of what the court had said. And on that vote, there was almost unanimity. That is, all the European states that had abstained on the resolution to submit the case then said they said yes. So, I mean, I think the gist of this is that the overwhelming opinion in the international community is that the barrier is illegal. That is, apart from Israel and I suppose now in the United States, and maybe Micronesia and the Northern Marianas. You won't find a state in the world that takes the position that the barrier is lawful. And the court dealt with it, I think, more broadly than did the Supreme Court of Israel. The Supreme Court of Israel, in the decision that Rick mentioned, ruled unlawful certain segments of the wall on the rationale that they too significantly impaired the situation of the local population. And the arguments that were being made in the Supreme Court of Israel against the wall by the relevant landowners, the people who lived in the affected areas, and by those states that argued for the illegality of the wall in the International Court of Justice. In both instances, the focus was on the impact on the local population, essentially that it, in many instances, as Rick showed with the example of the town of Kalkilia, separated farmers from the land that they farmed, thereby making it very difficult for them to pursue a livelihood. I mean, there's a barrier that has gates in it. The gates get open sometimes. There's no established procedure whereby the gates are always open at a certain time. I mean, there have been horrific stories of people, some of these gates coming up and the gates closed. They said, well, the gates usually open this time of day. Well, it's not now open now. Well, when's it going to be open? Nobody knows. I mean, that kind of situation makes it very difficult. Or people who have a business. They live on one side of this wall, and their shop, bakery, whatever, is on the other side. They never know whether they're going to be able to get across to get to or from their business. Same with schools. Children have, in many, many instances, are now on the other side of the wall from the school that they attend. And in some instances, I've heard Palestinian parents have been setting up a kind of system because they're afraid to have their child be all day on the other side of the wall, not knowing whether the child's really going to be able to get back at the end of the day. So parents in groups will kind of designate one parent who will go and sit on the other side of the wall the entire day just to make sure that there's a parent there to help the children in the afternoon if they need it. Also for medical care, the separation of villages and residence areas from available medical institutions, which in an emergency situation can be a matter of life and death. And I think that's probably the single instance that poses the most serious risk to the local population, that you'll have some medical emergency and need your appendix removed and you won't be able to get across the wall. Also, in many instances, access to water, that is, wells in villages, will be on the other side. So all those kinds of things are the factual grist for the legal arguments. The Supreme Court of Israel essentially bought the basic rationale of the government of Israel that it's possible to get around the legal constraints on security grounds. Both with respect to the law of belligerent occupation, it said that there are that within the law of belligerent occupation there is authorization for an occupant to curtail rights on security grounds. And further, it said that Israel had a right to self-defense. That's been the principal argument that Israel has made. Israel, in fact, while it didn't participate orally before the court, did participate in writing. This is a printout of what Israel sent to the court. It's about 125 pages. And Israel argued there that it has the right to self-defense in setting up this wall. Now, that's an argument that is outside the confines of the law of belligerent occupation. The law of belligerent occupation relates to the situation of an occupant in territory that it has taken militarily and gives it the right to do certain things to protect its position there. It can, occupy buildings to use as headquarters and that sort of thing. But it doesn't give it the right to do anything to protect its own territory. Now, on that point, the Supreme Court of Israel disagrees with me, and I think the Supreme Court of Israel was wrong. But the court essentially, without very much discussion said that, that on both these bases, Israel can depart from what would otherwise be its obligations to the local population as belligerent occupant. Now, those obligations, I should say briefly, come out of these documents that Rick mentioned, the Hague Convention of 1907, the Geneva Convention of 1949, which are treaties that, that say what an occupant must do. And essentially it puts the occupant in the position of being obliged to administer the territory in the stead of the ousted government for the duration of the occupation, and to do so more or less in the way that the ousted government did, respecting the local laws and acting in the best interests of the local population. The most general statement of the obligations of belligerent occupation come from the 1907 Hague Convention, which the courts of Israel have always viewed as being a part of customary law and applicable in the West Bank, and that that obligation is to preserve the community life of the occupied territory, and it was those two bodies of law, really one body of law, but expressed in two ways, that were at issue in the cases both before the Supreme Court of Israel and the International Court of Justice, that body of law requires respect for the property rights, respect for the community life. So all of these problems that I mentioned about separating people from education, from medical facilities, from their economic activity, all of that was in violation of the obligations. So Israel said, you know, that may be in principle or prima facie, but we have security considerations, and the Supreme Court of Israel bought that. The International Court of Justice did not buy that. On the self-defense argument, similarly, the Supreme Court of Israel said, yes, Israel may vary from those obligations in order to defend itself against suicide bombings in Israel. And the court said, no, that's not true. The International Court of Justice said, no, that's not true, that self-defense does not apply. And the reason that it said it doesn't apply is that this is activity coming from a territory under Israel's occupation, and that's not what self-defense in international law is all about. Self-defense is about an attack from a state, and this it does not involve an attack from a state. Therefore, it is not. It doesn't come within the concept of self-defense. And if you look at General Assembly resolutions, in particular one defining aggression from 1974, it makes it rather clear that self-defense is something that aggression is something that's done by a state, and then, therefore self-defense is something that's done in response to actions by a state. One of the judges of the court, the British judge, Judge Higgins, wrote separately and said she thought that the self-defense argument failed for a completely different reason. She said that self-defense is something that you assert when you have been attacked, that is, and when you are therefore using military force in response to an attack. And a wall is not a use of military force. Therefore, the self-defense is not the appropriate legal category to use to analyze the legality of the wall. So she thought that on that basis, the self-defense argument would fail. It actually fails for several other reasons, in my view, that the court, international court, didn't get into. One is that when you invoke self-defense, you have to go immediately to the UN Security Council and say, we've used force in self-defense, here's why we did it, and leave it up to the Security Council, which has responsibility for war and peace in the world, leave it up to the Security Council to decide what to do. Israel didn't do that. Israel didn't go to the Security Council at the time that it was building the wall and saying, you know, we're doing this on the basis of Article 51, which is the self-defense article of the UN Charter. Furthermore, when you invoke self-defense, you may do so only if the use of force And here again, I have even trouble talking about these criteria because the building of a wall isn't a use of force. But even if you could consider it to be a use of force by Israel, it would have to be necessary. And the court obviously thought, the International Court thought that the wall was not necessary given the configuration of it and the fact that it wasn't simply built along the dividing line between Israel and the West Bank, but that it went into, you know, surrounded Palestinian towns in the way the map showed and surrounded Israeli settlements. So the court thought that the rationale given by Israel simply didn't wash. That if it had wanted to build a barrier that would protect it from suicide bombers, it would have done so along its border, as indeed it had done with Gaza, that the appearance was that the structure was being built for some other purpose, and the court was of the view that it infringed the Palestinian right of self-determination. That is, the court expressed concern that this was a precursor to the establishment of borders by Israel that would be along the lines of this wall, stressed the right of self-determination as a right under international law. Israel, of course, views the matter differently and says that the wall can be built, the wall can be removed, it's not a political boundary. in any event, the court dismissed the self-defense argument. It took up one other argument, which to my mind would have been the appropriate analysis, appropriate category for legal analysis, but wasn't argued by any of the parties in the case, but was mentioned by the court. And that is that there is a concept in international law that obligations can be varied from in situations of necessity. This is defined in international law as a situation in which a state confronting peril and has to take an action that otherwise would be illegal, but where that action is necessary in order to avert the peril. To my mind, that was essentially what Israel was arguing. You know, there's this body of law that requires Israel to treat the local population in certain ways. It's not doing that, but it says we've got this problem of suicide bombings, and this is how we think we can best cope with it. So it seems to me that would be the appropriate legal category. As I say, this wasn't argued by the states that participated in the argument before the court, either in writing or orally. But the General Assembly of the UN organized a conference on this issue of the legality of the wall while this was in process. This is last April in Geneva, and invited me to give a paper, and this is the topic on which I gave the paper, because it seemed to me that this was really the critical legal issue in the case that wasn't being sufficiently addressed by the states that were arguing. I should say, when there's a request for an advisory opinion, every member state of the UN is given the option to participate in both in writing and then orally, and about 50 states submitted statements in writing, and a smaller number came to the oral proceeding and participated in that way. But in any event, this issue of necessity, it seems to me, would be the appropriate line of analysis. But that doctrine is limited in a couple of ways. One is that there has to be a real necessity. And here the problem is, and I think the court viewed it this way, that this wall was not a necessity for the peril that Israel faced. And the court focused on the routing particularly, and found that a sufficient reason to say that there's no basis for a justification on Israel's part. Also under the law of necessity, one has to show that there aren't other things that one could have done to avert the peril. And here I think Israel's position would fail. because there clearly would have been other things Israel could have done to avert the peril. The reason that you had the suicide bombings in the first place was a reaction to Israeli policies, many of them illegal, in the West Bank over the whole period of time from 1967 to the present. And had it not been engaging in those policies, then you wouldn't have had the suicide bombings in the first place. So, for example, it could have stopped building settlements. If it had stopped building settlements, it's quite unlikely that you would have had the suicide bombings. The court specifically said that the settlements are illegal, and said that the segments of the wall that go around settlements are illegal for that additional reason. But this business of not being able to invoke necessity where you have contributed to the problem is something that has previously been recognized by international bodies. The committee that monitors the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which monitored Israel a few years ago, talked about the suicide bombing situation by way of saying that Israel faced security concerns and that might be relevant to how it carries out its obligations under treaties. But it said at the same time the committee recognizes that the illegal occupation of Palestinian territory, the bombing of civilian areas, extrajudicial killings, the disproportionate use of force by the Israeli Defense Forces, the demolition of homes, the destruction of infrastructure, mobility restrictions, and the daily humiliation of Palestinians continue to contribute to the cycle of violence. I think on that basis, one would have to conclude that necessity is something that's not open to Israel. The court, in the course of its decision, made... Made a number of points that really go beyond the issue of the wall. This was the first time that the International Court of Justice had ever had any case before it relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict. I mean, even though this is the longest running conflict in the history of the organization, their Arab diplomats back in 1947 said the matter should be referred to the International Court of Justice to decide at that time what should be done as Britain was withdrawing from Palestine. But over the years, the government of Israel has taken a number of positions of principle on basic legal issues. One is that it has said that treaties to which it is a party, human rights treaties to which it is a party, do not apply in the West Bank. And it has also said that the Fourth Geneva Convention, the basic statement of the law on belligerent occupation, does not apply in the West Bank. And I won't go into the details for lack of time. And it also says that the settlements that it has been building are lawful. Now, the court went against Israel on all those positions. It's not surprising that it did. I mean, apart from Israel and a few lawyers in the United States that support Israel, you don't find anyone taking the positions that the government of Israel has taken on these issues. That is, the government of Israel has taken positions that are rejected by virtually the entire academic community, by all other governments of the world, and the court has now come down on the side of sanity, in my view, on those issues. But I should perhaps stop.
Okay, Ms. Corey.
Dior. Is this work?
Yes, it is.
Can everybody hear me?
Well, I knew I was going to walk into the Lions Den here today because, big time secret, I'm a big Michigan fan. But I didn't know I was going to walk into the Lions Den and have a distinguished professor of law excuse and justify suicide bombing. Let's get the facts straight. The fence, it's not a wall, it's not a separation barrier, it's a fence, was built for one purpose only, and that's self-defense. And what does self-defense mean, and what in what context is this self-defense? Ever since Arafat said no to Barack and Clinton and Camp David, when they came back, the situation has been very clear that there has been not what is called an intifada. This is not an intifada. This is an armed conflict short of war. Israel has been, on a daily basis, confronted with terrorism of the worst kind. The government had to decide how to deal with this. An intifada from between 1987 to 1993, when Israel was faced with stone throwing and Molotov cocktails, there were a number of different measures enacted, be it administrative detention, be it curfew, be it arrest. But once the government understood that this was a totally different ballgame, the decision was made based on how Israel interprets self-defense, to defend itself actively. Now, there is a concept in law called active self-defense. The government decided to, if you will, to implement three different measures. All of which, well, first let me tell you what they are, and then we'll get to the fence. Number one is targeted killing. It is not extrajudicial killings, and it is not assassination. It's targeted killing. We won't have time to get into it, but that's measure number one, which Israel is well aware of, has been the recipient of much international criticism, but it is something that, from the perspective of the government of Israel, it's something that not only is legal, but also in terms of policy effectiveness, is very effective in terms of policy. The second measure that is new is something called assigned residence, which is deportation minus, which we won't get into. And the third measure is defense. I don't think I'm divulging any great state secret if I tell you that the present Prime Minister of Israel, Sharon, initially was fundamentally opposed to defense for a number of different political reasons. But once it was understood, Sharon following Barak, that the only way to prevent Palestinian infiltration into Israel was to establish a great offense, that's what the government decided to do. Now, we're well aware of the fact that there has been obvious international criticism, as, if you will, exemplified by the advisory opinion, which I will also tell you, and I've gone public with this, I'm saying anything I haven't said before, I personally find that advisory opinion to be obscene. The fence has one purpose, and one purpose only, and that is to protect Israelis living in Israel, to prevent Palestinian infiltration into Israel. Much of the criticism of the fence has been with respect to its location. We showed here on the map earlier, there's a green line. A green line is oftentimes referred to as a border between Israel and the West Bank. There is no border between Israel and the West Bank. So the Green Line has been this de facto border. The fence is not on the Green Line for a number of different reasons. Reason number one is that topographically, in terms of the strategic purpose of the fence, if you put the fence on the Green Line, from the perspective of the Israeli military commanders, it does not give them the strategic edge in terms of seeing the infiltrator. Second of all, the fence, because it is a security fence and not a political fence, cannot have been placed on the Green Line. If Israel would have placed the fence on the Green Line, everybody would have yelled, oh, this is a political fence, this is a unilateral demarcation of the border. So Israel did not put it on the Green Line for that very specific reason, in order to show, to prove, if you will, that it is a security fence and not a political fence. Now, what does security fence mean? You saw here the pictures, and the pictures are extremely accurate. There are ditches, there are gullies, the fence is high, the fence is not particularly attractive. If you want to see a nice tourist spot in Israel, I would not recommend to go see the fence because it's not terribly attractive. But it's got a purpose in life, and that's to prevent the infiltration. You talked about, sir, about alternatives. It's true. International law requires proportionality, alternatives, and military necessity. Well, if there are, on a daily basis, suicide bombers, unexcusable, unjustifiable, coming into Israel and killing regularly 20 innocent people, be they Jew, be they Arab, and be they Christian, the government ultimately has one responsibility, that is to protect the people. So how do you go about protecting people? If you understand that terrorists are able to come into Israel literally at will, I don't want to get into the infrastructure of the suicide bomber because that's a separate lecture. But if the only way that you can prevent this infiltration is by doing the fence. In many ways, you can ask the Palestinians, and the Palestinians have been asked this, what would you prefer? Would you prefer targeted killing, or would you prefer the fence? Most Palestinians would tell you, and have answered, given those two options, they would prefer the fence. The government put the fence up in response to terrorism. Now, in terms of Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, it enables self-defense if an armed attack occurs. It does not specify that it has to be an armed attack from a state or from a non-state. It says armed attack occurs. in light of the fact that what Israel has been facing are these suicide bombers, and in light of the fact that this is not an intifada, in legalese, we in the IDF JAG refer to this as armed conflict short of war. It is not a war, because all those who know international law will tell you that a war can only be between states, and the Palestinians don't yet have a state. Down the road, there probably will be a Palestinian state, but until there's not a Palestinian state, this is an armed conflict short of war, which means that Israel has taken it upon itself to, what I said earlier, active self-defense. As we showed earlier, there are other fences throughout the world. One can ask oneself, and one does ask oneself, if one doesn't want to be too cynical, why is this the only fence that has attracted so much international attention? There are a number of different reasons. Obviously, one of the reasons is because the Arab-Israeli conflict is probably the most covered, surveyed by the media and by others. But the truth, the fact of the matter is, this is not the only fence. Furthermore, to the best of my knowledge, Israel is not the only nation in the world that has taken upon itself active self-defense. The number of examples you saw here with India and Morocco, everybody has to protect themselves. If, when they came back from Camp David, there would have been an agreement reached, I would be willing to bet not my last dollar, but my almost last dollar, the defense would not have been built. Because this government did not want to build defense. This government ultimately felt, in many ways, that they had no alternative, running through those very important international law issues of alternative self-defense, proportionality, and military necessity. What does proportionality mean, and what does alternative mean? When the government ran through the various options it had, going back to the Intifada of administrative detentions and so on, and once it understood that the suicide bomber apparatus was functioning extremely well, and this is also the place to say, for somebody such as myself who has studied suicide bombers and the suicide bomber apparatus, it is highly skillful, highly skilled, well-funded, well-organized, and extremely difficult to beat them at their own game. So one of the ways you can, if you will, to beat them at their own game, to prevent something from happening, bless you, is by putting up a fence. The fence has been extremely effective. In the areas where the fence is up, in those areas there has been a reduction of over 90% of the number of suicide bombers or terrorist attacks that have previously came from those areas. So if one views all counterterrorism measures of a double hat, if you will, of a legal measure, and of a policy effectiveness measure, the fact that where the offense is up, there's been a reduction of 90% in the number of terrorist attacks, that in and of itself proves the success of the offense. In September, there was a suicide bombing in Beersheba, a town in southern Israel, which succeeded simply because around Hebron, the fence is not yet up, meaning that the suicide bombers were literally able to walk into Beersheba to blow up two buses and to kill, to the best of my recollection, 14 innocent individuals. The government has recently, I think it was from this morning or yesterday, has indicated that the amount of land that will be used, Palestinian land that will be used for the purpose of the fence, will now be not more than 3.3% of the West Bank, which is an important reduction from where it had been. The government very much responded to the High Court of Justice, the Israeli High Court of Justice's opinion, saying the following: the fence is legal, but it needs to be recontoured, and it has been recontoured, and it will continue to be recontoured. It will continue to be recontoured, well, it was recontoured because the court said so. And second of all, the government is constantly trying to minimize exactly what the court said must be minimized, the impact, or the negative impact, upon the fabric of Palestinian life. What does that mean? In terms of real life, it would be undeniable to argue and to state that there have been cases where children have had trouble getting to school, where people have had trouble getting to work, and where people have had trouble getting to hospitals. That's correct. That having been said, the government is making every effort to improve the situation. Is it perfect? No. No. But the most important question that we must ask ourselves is, why is there a need for the fence? And the reason that there is a need for the fence is ultimately and solely because of Palestinian terrorism. If, repeating what I said earlier, if there would have been an agreement, if Oslo would have played itself out the way it would have, should have played itself out, if Arafat had not totally torpedoed the process, we wouldn't be where we are today. Where do we go from here? First of all, I'm a firm believer that Abbas and Sharon genuinely need each other, and generally understand that there is today no alternative but to proceed. If indeed there will be a progress, a positive development in this new process, if indeed there will be a return to the peace process, and ultimately leading to a Palestinian state, then the future of the fence, which you said earlier, I don't think anybody knows what it is, what will be the future of the fence. That having been said, the government has said all along that the fence may be recontoured again, meaning it will be moved, it may be minimized. Down the road, there's talk in the government, as difficult as it is for some members of the government to accept this, that there will not only be disengagement from Gaza in the summer, there may, down the road, also be disengagement from the West Bank. Disengagement from the West Bank potentially also means a further recontouring of the fence. The fence is not a permanent fence. It's why it's not a wall. I parenthetically add, it's important to refer to it as a fence. First of all, as you saw, there are gates. People can move through it. A wall also for Jews has, if you will, implications with respect to the Holocaust and the ghetto wall. So this is a fence. That's not to beautify. It's not to be beautified. It's to be understood that it exists. But because there is this possibility now with Arafat's death and with Abu Bas moving forward, the defense down the road either will be removed, replaced, recontoured. It's important to note that this is, and this, with this I finish my remarks, this is a security measure that is not permanent, that is based on important international law principles, the primary one being self-defense. The fact that the international court did not accept this as a measure of self-defense is the only way I can conclude with this. It was obscene because it simply means that a nation cannot defend itself. The fact that all other nations other than the United States did not accept this, if I were to be very frank with you, I would say it has nothing to do with the law. It's all about politics. The problem is that on the ground there's a reality that is not a political reality. It is a security reality. And the government ultimately has a responsibility to protect its people.
I'm happy to have John and Amos go back and forth, but I think if it's okay with you two, I'd go ahead and open it to the floor and then bring you two back to the podium and to rebut. Or would you prefer to rebut each other immediately? People have been sitting for an hour. If it's all right with you two, I'd like to let them...
They're behind the fence.
They're behind the fence. So why don't I open it to the floor initially and let you ask either or both, Professor Quigley or Professor Giora, what you would like, and then at the end I'll reserve time and they can each have 5 minutes. Yes, sir.
Professor Quigley, you were talking about occupied territories, and my question to you is, with respect to occupation, does this refer to just the West Bank and Gaza, or is it all of Israel that is viewed as occupied? In other words, do you accept that there should be a Jewish state that occupies Israel, that is in Israel, and that should have secure and firm boundaries? Do you view that, or is, as Hamas and Islamic Jihad view it, that Israel really is occupied land, Arab land, that should revert to the Arabs?
No, that's a good question. I think the international community views it in the former way, that is, that the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are occupied territories. All of the UN resolutions on the matter refer to the occupied territories being the West Bank and Gaza.
But a follow-up to that, Resolution 242 and 338 said that this should be negotiated between the parties. And if you go back in terms of occupation, Jordan occupied the West Bank, and Egypt occupied Gaza, and yet there was no concern at that point that those areas were occupied.
Well, I mean, that was a different kind of occupation. That was in a situation where the Jewish agency was trying to take over those areas, and Jordan came in and asserted its authority there after consultation with the local population. But I mean, whatever the characterization of Jordan's role there, and Jordan did say that it was taking the territory with the understanding that was without prejudice to Palestinian aspirations in the future. Whatever you say about Jordan, I mean, clearly Israel's occupation is termed in law belligerent occupation. That is, it was in the course of a belligerency, and therefore qualifies under that category. Now, this Committee on the Rights of the Child that I mentioned referred to the illegality of the occupation as one of the factors, the reasons that Israel is committing an act that contributes to the suicide bombings. So this occupation was quite clearly illegal. When Israel went in 1967, Abe Ibn went into the Security Council, and he lied to the Security Council, saying to the Security Council that Egypt had attacked villages in southern Israel. In fact, there had been no such attacks. He said that Israeli radar showed that Egyptian aircraft were on their way to Israel. In fact, those airplanes were on the ground in Cairo. So this was a completely unlawful act ab initio.
But the blockade of preventing ships in the Gulf of Iran from going there isn't a blockade, an act of war?
Well, that's a complicated question of maritime rights, and Egypt probably had the better part of the argument, which we can't go into here, about the Straits of Tehran and what kind of territory they were. It was within the territorial waters of Egypt, and that's really not the key issue with respect to the 67 war. The argument that Israel made after it decided to back off this fictitious story about an Egyptian attack was that it had been in anticipation of an attack by Egypt. And that, too, was a fabrication on the part of Levi Eshkol, who was the prime minister at the time. Both Mr. Rabin and Menachem Begin have subsequently said that it simply wasn't true. They were involved in the cabinet meeting. The cabinet of Israel decided on the 4th of June, 1967, to invade Egypt. That was, before anything happened on the 5th of June, potentially coming from Egypt. So the decision was made, and at that meeting, it was understood that Egypt, despite these problems with the Straits of Tehran, despite the fact that Egypt had drawn troops up to the border, it was clearly understood that Egypt was not about to attack Israel. Menachem Begin said that in 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon.
Professor Giora, do you want to say anything about this? You might want to. I
almost don't know where to begin. We're going to turn this into a historical debate, which is what's necessary. 1967 war.
How do you mean to do that?
No, I don't want.
Okay.
There's. How did I turn this goddamn thing off?
Very pastoral.
Okay. Because soon this won't be pastoral here. There's spin, and then there's spin. I'm going to follow up, sir, with your question and with your interesting response. The 1967 Six-Day War is a prime example of preemption. Here's what the facts are. Egypt had expelled UN peacekeepers. Egypt had mobilized troops. Israel had blockaded the Israeli ports. And Egypt had threatened to destroy Israel by force of arms. I know of no nation in the world that would sit idly by and wait to be attacked. To spin it and to say, well, not this and not that, I think, frankly, is inappropriate. Preemption is the following. If I am going to be attacked, then yes, I am going to act in advance. And we can have a very long and very interesting debate on when can I act. What international lawyers say, ask the question, how imminent is imminent? And when is it imminent? That's a different question. But to say that the government lied here and the government lied there, first of all, I don't think it's particularly helpful in terms of a debate. Second of all, there are facts on the ground. There are those who say, should Israel have waited? Maybe. I don't think that in terms of a government, and again I emphasize, I know of no government in the world that would wait to be attacked in order to say, well, we took the first hit. That's just, I think, in terms of a nation's responsibility, in terms of a leadership's responsibility to its people, I don't think anybody would do that. The question then is, how do you respond? Well, here's how Israel responded. That Monday morning, by 8 o'clock, the Egyptian Air Force no longer existed. That's a fact. All the planes were on the ground. That's a fact also. And why did Israel attack early in the morning? Israel attacked early in the morning because if you remember your history, the sun, the angle of the sun was such that Egyptian radar screens were pointed into the sun. It was blinding them. The Israeli pilots could come into Egypt and do away with the Egyptian Air Force. In light of all of these facts, I don't really think that anybody would argue, anybody who's objective, key word here, anybody who's objective would argue that that was not a war, a justified war based on preemption. And that sort of then ties into your question about Hamas and the jihad. I would like to believe, I don't think I'm totally naive, that we're beyond the stage where most rational and reasonable people no longer say that Israel doesn't have a right to exist. I would like to believe that. That having been said, Rabin told Arafat that you must publicly, unequivocally, without your handlers telling you what to say, say that the conflict is over, that there's an end to the conflict. Arafat mumbled here and mumbled there. He never said those magical words. That's where we are today. And that's going back to what I said earlier, that I very much hope that the new president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, who I've had the pleasure of meeting, understands that the only way to proceed is to say that this is the end of the conflict. He has taken on Palestinian terrorists as he is, as Arafat obligated himself to in Oslo. It is Arafat signed on this, saying that he will be a co-partner in fighting terrorism, never lived up to his obligations. If we're able to advance beyond that and genuinely and honestly have both sides meet their obligations on fighting terrorism, then there really is room for optimism.
You men in the back.
Thank you. I have a question for Colonel. I understand. Yes, Colonel Piora.
Actually retired. You can call me. I've retired from the idea.
I understand the security concerns you expressed. And now it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Israel has a policy supporting or eventually supporting a Palestinian state. Would be open to the idea of it. And if so, how does a Palestinian state form and function without a continuous territory?
Right. I think, first of all, I think you're right. I think that there is an increasing acceptance of the fact, I don't want to say within all of Israel, because I think that'd be incorrect, but I think the majority of Israelis understand that there is going to be a Palestinian state. Now I need your map.
Okay. I hope I can get it back.
You go ahead and say what you like. It's going to take me a minute to open.
That's fine. Julie, where is it loaded? Why don't you do it? Because you know where it's stored. I have no idea where it was stored.
This is fun.
Like a TV timeout.
I know. Pause for commercial break. Oh, yeah. Save myself some cooking.
I'll get to your question.
Which map are you looking for?
Front page.
Okay. Sure. No, it's thinking.
Oh,
yeah, it appears to be.
Well,
we may not
get this.
All right. Okay. So, we'll do as if, okay? I want to point as if. Right. There are a couple of political realities and there are a couple of geographical realities to your question. I'll begin with the geographical reality. This is Israel. This is the West Bank. And this is the Gaza Strip. Between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip is this thing called Israel. And Israel, if anybody had any concern, ain't going away. There will be no geographical contiguousness between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That having been said, in Oslo, there was an agreement called Safe Passage. Safe Passage, which I personally negotiated, connects the West Bank to the Gaza Strip by two roads. We started negotiations on the Safe Passage in 94. We finished in 99. A very detailed mechanism whereby Palestinians can go back and forth between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That was established in order to solve the lack of contiguousness between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Was extremely complicated to negotiate this thing. I have no hair today, partly because of that. With respect to the West Bank, one of the Palestinians' concerns all along has been, and it's understandable, is that the West Bank, because of the existence of Jewish settlements within the West Bank, will become canton-like, as if it's Switzerland. Go back to what I said earlier, that down the road, you know, in the Middle East, nothing happens overnight. That I think most people in Israel, if you were to take a poll, not all, most, will tell you that the day has come to end the Jewish settlements in the West Bank. If disengagement starts in Gaza in July, and the disengagement will be not only from Gaza, there are also four communities in the northern Shomron, which is the West Bank is divided into Judea and Samaria. The northern Shomron, there will be four settlements that will also be disengaged. They will be literally shut down. That process is not going to be simple. I mean, the government there are those within those communities who very much object to this process. There appears to be a long-term plan that Sharon has to disengage ultimately from the West Bank, with the exception of, I think it's safe to say, of three different areas. Oh,
great. Getting closer.
Oh, don't move. All right.
I'm out of here.
This is not the end.
I'm trying. Hold on.
Well, region number one, can everybody see? Region number one, where I don't think there'll be disengagement from, is an area called Gush Etzion, which is right outside of, in around Jerusalem, south, east of Jerusalem, and near Bethlehem. There, from there, I don't think there'll be disengagement. That's area number one. Area number two is a city directly east of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and Jericho. It's a city of about, I think, 50,000 Israelis. It's called Malé Adumim. And the third area, is a place called Ariel, which is directly east of Tel Aviv, and there, too, there are about 50,000 individuals. My read of it is from those three communities, there will not be, even down the road, disengagement. From the rest of the West Bank, as I understand it, there will be. Does that mean that the West Bank will then be 100% Palestinian? Don't know. Probably not. Will it be far more than it is today? Absolutely yes. Will all this happen within a year? I don't think so. It's a process. And one of the important things to note, especially in light of the fact that there was this summit 3 weeks ago in Sharm El-Sheikh, and that Sharon is clearly giving Abbas a window of opportunity, is that a process has begun. And there are a number of important indicators showing that. 3 weeks ago, on two separate attacks, suicide bombing attacks, which are inexcusable and undefendable,
Seven Israelis were killed. This was Abbas's first week in office. Hamas was testing Abbas. Sharon said the following. Sharon said, I'm freezing all relations with the PA. He said that on Wednesday.
Okay.
On Thursday, it can now be reported. On Thursday, one day later, there was a meeting among security officials, IDF, PA. On Sunday, he was already talking to Abbas. So on the one hand, he said freezing. On the other hand, on back channel conversations going on. 8 days later, 9 days later, the summit has already occurred. Not only did the summit occur on a Tuesday, but please note that either on Sunday or Monday prior to the summit, the government said the following. The government said there will be no more targeted killings. Now, why did the government say that? The government said that, my read of it, is that that Abbas clearly asked Sharon to do something that he could go to Hamas and say, tit for tat, there is something being done. That's the first thing that's happened in the past 2 weeks. Second thing that's happened is last week there was a high-level IDF commission which recommended to the defense minister, who has adopted the recommendation, that there be no more house demolitions. Does that mean that there's an internal Israeli process going on also? The answer is yes. Does that mean that then that behooves the Palestinians to fight Palestinian terrorism? The answer to that is also yes. This must be viewed as an ongoing process. There'll be ups, there'll be downs, there'll be attacks here, there'll be attacks there. It's not going away. But there is a process, and that's the way that this must be viewed. And that serves a very long answer to your very intelligent question.
You had a question. Yeah, the woman in the back.
Yeah. You stated that, actually, this is addressed to something that you said, but anybody can...
Either of us?
Either of you.
Okay.
You stated that the wall has one purpose, and that purpose is to...
No, I probably said, knowing myself, I probably said the fence has one purpose.
Okay, well, the fence, in your eyes. If the fence has one purpose, to protect the Israeli people from the incursion of Palestinians into Israel, Israelis certainly have a right to be protected from what they view as their enemy, then what can you offer the Palestinians? Why is it that the wall prevents Palestinians from entering Israel, but Israel has complete access to the Palestinian territory? In other words, the IDF can enter Palestinian territory at any time, can enter a Palestinian neighborhood at any time. The settlers have access to the entire West Bank. However, it doesn't go both ways. How is it that Israelis have a right to security, but Palestinians have no right to security? That, to me, is unjustifiable.
Okay.
And in fact, just one more thing. Suicide bombing is a relatively new phenomenon. Okay. So to say that the fence exists because of that, and that the cycle of violence exists because of that, is ridiculous, because in fact, occupation and oppression has existed far longer than the phenomenon of suicide bombing.
Okay.
I guess it was really mostly a question to you.
Okay.
Professor Quigley can respond as well.
Do you want to start? Awesome. Suicide bombing. Do you know when the first suicide bombing in Israel was?
Late 80s, early
90s. Okay. Oh, there we go. Great. Oh. Let me answer the question. Okay. October 94. Tel Aviv. Dizengoff Center. Bus number 10. Shimon Shitzit says to Rabin, this is a whole new type of warfare. And he was right. It totally has changed the way that Israel has viewed terrorism, leading ultimately, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, defense. Today, you say that most Israelis support defense. At first, there was tremendous internal opposition to defense. Today, most Israelis are in favor of defense because, as I said to you earlier, 90%, there's been a reduction of 90% in terms of Palestinian terrorism. In terms of who's protecting and who's attacking and who's doing what, the IDF, first of all, if you go back to Oslo, the whole idea of Oslo was to turn over security, responsibility, to the PA. It was a gradual process. And that's what happened. After what happened post Camp David, the IDF, and particularly not only after Camp David, but after the suicide bombing on the eve of Passover in Netanya, where over 30 Israelis, most of them elderly, having their Passover meal, were killed by a suicide bomber. That's on a Thursday. On Friday, there's a mass mobilization. On Sunday, Monday, the IDF goes back in. That's right. The IDF goes back into the West Bank and, if you will, takes back the security responsibility that had been handed over to the Palestinians, that in many ways had been delegated, if you will, to the Palestinians, because there was a decision made that the Palestinians, the PA, had been unable or unwilling, we can argue about it, unable or unwilling, to counter Palestinian terrorism. So the IDF goes back in, and the IDF is still there. This past week, the process was to begin of re-returning to the Palestinians' control. It happened last week in Jericho. It was supposed to happen, I don't remember yesterday, I think either in Qalqilya or Tulkarm. From the last I checked on the internet before I came here, maybe you had a chance to see, there was a snag, and it didn't go through. But the idea here, Sharon has been very public about this. Once he understood that Abbas is serious about fighting terrorism, he would like, and he has said this, re-return, if you will, the control, security control, to the Palestinians. As long as Palestinian terrorists infiltrate into Israel, defense is necessary, legal, and effective. In terms of what you're also asking, either directly or indirectly, in terms of the IDF is there because the IDF, that's the way to protect Israeli citizens. Israelis, first of all, can't go freely into all areas, certainly not in the Gaza Strip, because you need permission from the military commander, who is not generous in handing it out. There are areas that Israelis cannot go into in the West Bank, or again, by military order. And if one were to do, I don't want to get into this tit for tat, but where we are in terms of Palestinian terrorism versus terrorism conducted by Israelis, which sometimes happens and they get punished the way they should, I don't think you'd want to get into the numbers game. Sir.
The UN Commission for Human Rights had someone visit the territories and as what they call a special rapporteur on the human rights situation a year or so ago. And he wrote the following about the wall. He said, the erection of a security wall between Israel and he used the word wall. The erection of a security wall between Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories is widely portrayed as a security measure. Had the wall strictly followed the green line marking the 1967 borders, it might have been possible to confine the debate to the question whether a security wall of that kind would achieve its purpose. But when it is intended that the wall encroach deeply upon Palestinian territory, it is difficult to resist the conclusion that it is a case of de facto annexation in which the security situation is employed as a pretext for territorial expansion. I think you have to keep in mind that this Oslo process, the primary consequence of this Oslo process is that Israel has been able to use it in order to expand settlements in the West Bank. That is, under the guise of having this period when there's going to be a reconciliation, it has gone ahead and created more facts on the ground to make the overall situation much more difficult to resolve. And that's where you get the basic Palestinian anger that results in the suicide bombings. And that's why I say there are so many other ways that Israel could have responded and could act in order to protect itself from these bombings. When you look at the wall in conjunction with the construction of these settlements, in conjunction with a panoply of measures over the years of the occupation that have made life difficult for the population, taking away land, confiscating farmland, making it difficult for people to pursue a livelihood, I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that the wall is aimed more at getting rid of Palestinians, making life that much more difficult for them, to make more of them to leave. I used before the example of a shop owner who has a bakery on one side of the wall. That's actually a friend of mine who has had a bakery in East Jerusalem and lived on what became the other side of the wall. And he found he couldn't make it. He couldn't run the business anymore. He has left. He doesn't live there anymore. There are many Palestinians that have departed as a result of not only of the wall, but of the panoply of measures, but of which the wall is one. So,
one more question, and then we'll have some your final whatever you'd like to say. We haven't been over on this side of the room at all, so I'm going to go over there. Yes.
I was just wondering. It's something that I've heard brought up before. Last year there were people from Palestinian labor unions that came to talk at Ohio State, and they had mentioned agriculture and water tables on the West Bank. And I was wondering what percentage of the Palestinian economy consists of agriculture, or if there are numbers about how the fence or wall has affected unemployment or other economic figures, and where exactly are the water tables? When
we're talking about recontouring the potential
of the wall, how would that affect the water tables? Because those are obviously
one of the
other.
Do we have any water expertise
here?
Yeah, clearly the wall does separate people from their sources of water. That's one of the problems that's been created. And the water table. I mean, the water issue, I mean, more generally, is one of the big issues that needs to be resolved. I mean, the water is more accessible under the West Bank than it is closer to the ocean. So Israel has been taking water from under the West Bank during the period of the occupation. That's one of the major grievances of Palestinians, and it's significantly affected in a negative way.
John, let's grab one last question. So we've more or less punted on water. There was one other question. This will be the last one.
I had a question about international law, or what things would be like if something were international law. And I'm thinking in reference to the United States, actually. I'm thinking if there is a concept of international law of preemptive war, preemptive strikes, as our president has claimed that there is such a principle. And it seems to me, if there were such a principle, then it would have to apply equally to all the nations of the world. And I'm thinking back to 2002 in the lead up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I think it was pretty evident to everybody in the entire world that the United States was planning an attack on Iraq. Now, it could be justified or it could be unjustified. The fact is, it was planning an attack on Iraq. It seems to me if there were such a doctrine, we would have to, if we were good, just people, we would have to allow that Iraq had, as a right of preemptive self-defense, the right to attack the United States. And I was also thinking about targeted killings. I'm thinking about the Nicaraguans, who it would seem to me would have had a very good case for targeting the assassination of Oliver North, who was working in extra-legal ways to conduct terrorist activities in Nicaragua. So I was wondering maybe if in reference to acts of the United States as opposed to Israel and Palestine, if the two of you could comment on what these doctrines would mean in those particular cases.
Tell you what, why don't we let Professor Quigley start like we did at the beginning and use this opportunity, since it's a broad self-defense question again, and then Giora. You finish, and those will be done, since we promised we'd close by 5, we'll try to be done shortly thereafter.
As a matter of international law, there is no such thing as preemptive self-defense. That's something that has been asserted by elements in the current administration in the United States, but it is not something that exists in the law. There is a question, as Professor Giora was indicating, of how long one has to wait, exactly when an attack begins. But and there is some ambiguity, I think you can say, about that question. Clearly, if the if the forces are incoming but they haven't gotten to your border yet, you know, that's probably enough. The problem when you extend it much beyond that is that it allows you to make up stories and to attack others as a pretext. And that's precisely the situation that occurred in 1967 with the June War. As I've indicated, Menachem Begin and Mr. Rabin were there. They were at the cabinet meeting. They said, you know, they said after the fact, they gave, you know, press interviews. They didn't, nobody's denied that they said this, that we knew that Egypt was not about to attack. Now, it could be that Egypt would have attacked sometime in the future, maybe, you know, in a month or a year. Who knows? I mean, you never know for sure. But the reason that self-defense exists as it does, requiring that there be an actual attack, is that if you extend it very much beyond that, it's just open season, and anybody can say, well, you know, Zimbabwe can say that we thought Gambia was about to attack, so we're going to attack it, and they you know, trot out some evidence. You know, that's simply not the way the law reads.
Would Saddam Hussein have been justified if he had attacked the United States?
Oh my. Well, I mean, I don't think that there's a preemptive notion on that basis. But if there were a preemptive notion, you could make that argument that he did.
Mr. Giora, last word.
I guess we would all agree that it's a good thing that Saddam Hussein is no longer able to do anything. Final comments. First of all, I appreciate very much the opportunity to have come here and to present an argument regarding the fence. I think it's very important to have the opportunity to speak to a group like this. I appreciate not everybody agrees. That's what makes for a healthy debate. I think it's very important for everybody. The fence must be viewed, going back to self-defense. Self-defense is a really interesting concept. What I call how imminent is imminent, how preemptive can preemptive be, when can I attack, when can I not attack. My only thing I would say in conclusion is that I am a firm believer that international law as we know it today is inapplicable and irrelevant to the present conflict. The present conflict is compared to conventional warfare. Conventional warfare was, or traditional war as we know it, was planes against planes and tanks against tanks. Well, that's not what we're going to face in the future. What we're going to face in the future is states having to defend themselves against non-state actors. And how a state will go about defending itself against a non-state actor based on law. And the law here is critical because we as liberal democratic societies must be jealous about, in the United States, about the Constitution. We must be acting a certain way, be it moral, be it ethical, be it legal. I've said this before and I'm going to say it until I'll say less here, that international law must be revamped to enable what I call active self-defense, because that's the only way states can legally protect themselves against non-state actors. I remind all of us in this room, there is a lovely human being whose name is Osama bin Laden. And the Osama bin Ladens of this world, at the end of the day, would frankly like for everybody in this room to be dead. How a liberal democratic society protects itself against those individuals is the true test facing international waters. Thank you.
I want to thank Amos Giora and John Quigley for taking time and coming here to speak with us, and I want to thank all of you for coming, so thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Much more detailed than I thought you were going to do that.
Well, I wanted to. I've given talks on the wall defense.
I call it the wall.
So I have some things.
The reason we couldn't use that is because it requires a USB, and we were reading off of the flash drive. So we've actually bought. Is there a laser pointer pairing?
Is there a laser pointer pairing?
Yeah, I thought Grant is the replacement. I know.
I'm writing my thesis.
How do you know the barrier order that you already have in process? I think it's just
thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That introduction. That was great. And thanks for helping me.
All right. I could Xerox it.
If you have it on PDF.
I can do that. Yeah, I was just going to.